Do you think this is the lie of the year?
If you like your private health insurance plan, you can keep your plan. Period.
PolitiFact does. It named that claim the lie of the year yesterday, and we will get our Week in Review guest to weigh in on it and a host of other issues in the news this week. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. What news story from this week do you want to talk about? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. Very happy to have with us Peg Lautenschlager. She is former Democratic Attorney General of Wisconsin, a former state lawmaker, and former United States Attorney. Now she's an attorney with the Bauer and Bach Law Firm. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
And Kevin Benversi is a freelance writer, blogger. He used to work at the Heritage Foundation. He served in the George W. Bush administration and worked on several state Republican campaigns. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
So, Kevin, do you agree that that was the lie of the year?
It definitely fits the criteria that even PolitiFact has been using for years on end. So, I mean, the real interesting storyline of this is going to be is how long were they having this in the barrel, because this has been something that they've analyzed, I think, since 2008 during the initial presidential campaign when it first came out. And they said, well, we don't deal with the hypothetical. And everyone's going, well, anyone who was analyzing the policy and the bills as they were going on was saying, this is not going to work. People are going to lose their health insurance. He's lying. And they'd put, like, they gradually go, you know, that's half true, and also all these other various ratings they have. And then finally, I think the dam broke this year with all the numbers. I mean, 5 million so far this year alone, you know, that they had to eventually go to the full lie, you know, lying area on their barometer until, you know, it just, you know, couldn't go any further.
And Peg, your reaction to PolitiFact naming that the lie of the year?
Well, I'm not surprised by them naming that the political lie of the year. I think that if you take health care and the Affordable Health Care Act in its entirety, you have seen that it has been filled with lies on both sides. We have this, what's apparently a lie, and I'll buy into that for now for purposes of discussion, but, you know, that was preceded by, you know, Uncle Sam doing a vaginal exam on my daughter. It was preceded by death panels and threats of that. It was preceded by your health care insurance is going to go up. Our personal family situation is such that all of us will be seeing lesser cost health insurance if we're to go in on the exchange, even in a state like Wisconsin. So I think to single out that particular statement, which I think was made in a tone where it was trying to kind of summarize what was going to happen with the Health Care Act, as opposed to something that just totally misleads, I think that angle of it isn't particularly fair.
Mm-hmm. They found that he said it 36 times, at least in the last 4 years.
So how many times has Sarah Palin or Bachman or whomever said death panels? Come on. I mean, we can talk about how many times things were said. There are all sorts of mischaracterizations of things. This one, indeed, that those insurance policies which were lost, were lost because those companies didn't want to provide insurance that was up to par with what's expected of insurance now. And I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing. Those policies have been horrible. We as taxpayers end up putting the bill if somebody holding one of those policies ends up with an extraordinary condition which causes them to not have their health insurance pay, or, you know, not have their health insurance cover something, say like cancer, childbirth, whatever it happens to be.
Well, it's meanwhile, Kevin, what is that? One more comment on this.
So I, as a 34-year-old male, need prenatal and maternity care, because those were mandatory things on every single government access. Yeah.
I have a 28-year-old single male who lives in California as one of my children, and you know what? His health insurance costs, he's going to have better insurance, and the costs are going to be half of what they are, even with his maternity care he's going to get.
The state says that about 7,200 Wisconsin residents bought health insurance as of Monday. That's up from 900 people who had signed up in October. So, Peg, do you think the major problems are over with healthcare.gov?
I think that this is something where everything's going to keep evolving, just as the whole Medicare prescription drug thing did some years ago, just as Social Security or just as Medicaid and Medicare have evolved over the years. I think the important things to look at are, number one, is that we do have insurance that is available now to younger people, whether it's Kevin or my son or anybody else, my daughter for that matter. You know, one, they can stay on their parents' policies a little longer, and number two, the competitiveness of the marketplace, I think, is going to drive those prices down a little bit, and they're going to have easier access to finding the prices. I mean, I don't think in some ways it's going to be much different than going to Travelocity to look at airfares versus having to go to the websites of each and every air carrier to determine what your best deal is. Secondly, I think the one thing that's huge is the pre-existing condition thing. And I know when I looked at insurance after I left the AG's office, and I have some pre-existing conditions, as does my husband. They told us, you know, the good news is we'll give you insurance. The bad news is it'll be $5,900 a month. Having the sort of guarantee that diseases which are commonplace in this world. And yet you can still get health insurance, I think, is a big plus, particularly for a developed country like ours, which is competing against nations where, in most circumstances, all citizens are provided health insurance.
Kevin?
I question what the terminology of the word bought means, because anyone who's actually looked at this website, numerous tech specialists and guys who actually know website design have said, the front end may look great, but the back end, where the actual payments are going on, is a complete mess. They've already said, and I believe it's been noted, that I think this was announced last night, that HHS is going to pretty much tell insurance companies that, well, if the check hasn't come, give them coverage anyway, which it'd be kind of akin to saying your radio station there saying, yeah, we'll give you the airtime for your commercial, but you know, you can pay us in 2 weeks.
Kevin, I find that a little amusing, because usually it's my problem is my insurance company isn't paying my health care bills in a timely fashion. So, you know, maybe the shoe's on the other foot now.
Let's take a call from Nancy in Greene County. Hello, Nancy.
Hello. I am just calling to react to something that Peg Lautenschlager just said, that premiums are not going down for everyone. That, in fact, in my case, my premium, the best deal that I could get is a 200% increase in my premium, which is not affordable. The other thing, one of the many things that Obama has said, is that there would be meaningful caps on premiums. I think he said 10%. And that, too, has proven to not be true.
Nancy, do you know if the insurance you're looking at has comparable deductibles and coverage and same?
It has a higher deductible than what I have now.
Okay.
So it's less coverage.
Okay.
And believe me, I want to see a single payer, you know, system. That's what I want to see. So
hallelujah.
I am not, you know, a Tea Party person who has been after Obama. I see this as a first step, or at least I hoped it was a first step, towards some real meaningful reform in the insurance situation for all of us.
Yeah.
But I'm willing to absorb a 10%, a 20%. When I first looked at the healthcare.gov website, well, I thought I could get the catastrophic coverage. I can't. I'm too old by all these new rules. And I thought a 30% increase, okay, I can live with that.
Mm-hmm.
But a 200% increase that's more than I will make this year.
That's too bad. So, and you were under the federal exchange, right?
It's not, though. The insurance premiums are not going down for everyone, Peg?
Apparently not, no. And I know that in Wisconsin they are going to be higher simply because we don't have a state exchange. So we get pooled in with the rest of the nation, so our generally good health doesn't credit us with any sort of difference.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, did you want to get in on this?
No, I mean, the reality is just some of the mandates that have been forced upon these plans. I mean, once upon a time, you know, pre-Obamacare, you could actually shop around and get various plans, and now there's so many mandates and so many state mandates that it's just, this is what's causing all this stuff to go on. And you talk about pre-existing conditions. You know, one of the things that I still have never truly understood, and, you know, and this is, you know, maybe someone in a progressive think tank can go and do a study on this and explain, you know, why FDR screwed up healthcare to begin with, which is, why do we have everything tied to our employer? I mean, I would like, if you actually could hang on to your health insurance from employer to employer, you know, that'd be great. You know, you could buy across state lines. That'd be great. You know, actually do some legitimate free market thinking that comes with real reform in the healthcare process, instead of just saying, well, let's just have the government pay for it. Well, if, you know, that's going to happen, you're going to have the same situation you're already seeing in college education, which is, well, there's only one person that's really paying for every single student who has a student loan. That's the federal government. So you're going to have administrators just keep jacking up the prices because they say it's free money that's going to have,
Kevin, I think the fundamental difference here is that from a philosophical standpoint, you believe that people should be responsible for their own health care costs, period, and that there is some relationship, perhaps, between necessary health care costs and a person's taking care of themselves, let's call it that. I think if I am solidly in the other camp, which says that there are a number of health conditions which people may have, and that when one of those comes to rise, the health care costs can be outrageously high, and whether or not we as a society should help cover those costs as a collective group, or whether or not we as a society should just let everyone fend for themselves, I'm on the side of doing something societally. And, and I think that the reality is we can argue about what's covered, what's not. We can pretend there's a free market out there and people understand what they're shopping for, as Nancy said, you know, because there are few Nancys out there. But, in the end, the question becomes, do we believe this is a function where each of us as individuals has a responsibility for our less fortunate neighbor, or whether or not we as a society just want to deal with this ourselves?
Let's take a call from Jared in Madison. Hi, Jared.
Hi. I just want to say that I don't think what the president said was a lie. I think what he was saying was that after the Affordable Care Act was going to be put in place, that if you had an existing policy that you liked and it was still being enforced, and then you had the governmental plan, that he was saying then you have the choice of staying with your existing policy as opposed to going to the governmental plan. I think that's what his intention was. I think it's a bit misleading what people have been saying recently, that it was a big lie. I think he was referencing that point. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, Kevin?
That's a little hard to take, considering that we already have stories that in 2010, HHS was writing the rules that pretty much took away your plan. And then he was going out in 2012, while on re-election, still saying, if you like your plan, you can keep your plan. So it was just a political talking point to get the bill passed and then to get him reelected. So, I mean, it is a complete lie.
Well, writing the rules to take away your plan isn't what happened. Writing the rules to create a base level of coverage for all Americans.
We need to take a break, and we will come back talking about the federal budget deal that passed in the House of Representatives yesterday, and other news of the week. What would you like to talk about? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Kevin Benversi and Peg Lautenschlager today here on the Ideas Network. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with two guests from different perspectives about the top issues in the news this week. Talking today with Peg Lautenschlager and Kevin Benversi. And with you, if you'd like to join in at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can let us know what you think about this budget deal that was reached this week and passed in the House yesterday. The Senate takes it up next week. The House yesterday overwhelmingly approved a bipartisan budget by a 332-94 vote. The package was drafted by Democratic Senator Patty Murray and House Budget Committee Chair Paul Ryan. Interestingly, Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan voted against that deal, saying that it didn't do enough to cut the harmful sequester cuts, and also was concerned about not extending unemployment benefits. So, Peg, what do you think of this budget deal?
Well, I think it's a necessary budget deal, and I think that most people who understand that there is a value to the function of government believe that it is a necessary deal. I am in the Mark Pocan camp when it comes to worrying about people who will not have their unemployment extended. It is an insurance. It's something that when they were working, they paid into a fund, and as did their employers. And indeed, having people who are in the job market looking, having some sort of fallback in terms of obtaining some food, paying bills, whatever, is a positive thing societally. And I think that as we see this slow growth in the economy, we need to recognize that we really can't do the two-step forward, one-step back thing anymore. We really need to try to keep pushing ahead and create an economy where that employment rate is lower and where we don't have people in that circumstance. That being said, so I think that is crucial. I also think that the sequester cuts were something which were originally passed because they were supposed to be so onerous that even conservatives would find them to be ridiculously harsh. They have become the new norm, and so getting something over and above what the sequester dollars are now is considered a victory on the more progressive end of the political scale. From my standpoint, again, I think that this is an improvement over what was there before. But on the other hand, I think it falls short of where many Democrats would like to be, including Mark Pocan.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, would you have voted for this bill?
Yeah, I think it was probably in the end a necessary evil. It's not the greatest thing in the world. It's not what Democrats wanted. It's not what Republicans wanted. But it's one of those things that pretty much kind of have to keep the inertia of government running. I was not a fan of the shutdown in October. And, this not only prevents one from happening in January, but also happening in next October, because in essence, this is two budget years in a row that was just passed. The Senate, has to take up next week. And it's assumed, unless, there's some shenanigans there and you have Harry Reid wanting a shutdown, it's going to pass. I think, and this is my HUD background speaking, this is actually a good thing for government and the bureaucracy, because actually having a budget bill and having those appropriations bills finalized, which hasn't been done in the last 3 years, is a good thing. CRs really handcuff agencies when it comes to your spending, because you're living under a reality that is 2013, but you've been told to budget in a reality that says it's 2010. And that's not good. You have priorities that have been gone. You have projects that have passed that are still being funded. So that in alone is a good thing.
I agree with Kevin too on this. I think perception wise, members of the public have been told by many that this horrible federal government that's too big and whatever, and we can argue about that till the cows come home, but there are certain functions which are performed by government that are very, very necessary, whether it be our defense sorts of things. I, having been a federal prosecutor in U.S. attorney's offices and what they do throughout the states in the United States, you can go on with a list of these things, and I think those are things to which there's some commonality regardless of your philosophy on the economics of it all. But to keep operating on that, next month's whatever thing, it doesn't give you any ability to do long-term planning or give you long-term perspective on thing. One small thing, which I saw both in the federal government as a prosecutor and as attorney general, was the way this incremental funding impacted things like, say, the investment into equipment needed to do crime lab testing, whether it be DNA evidence or whatever, and not having a budget where you can look beyond the next month or look beyond the next 6 months in order to plan for things like that that are going to be necessary in the future is almost impossible with the way things have been done incrementally. So I think that, you know, regardless of your political philosophy or regardless of how you think this money should be spent, the fact that it should be the procedure by which it's being spent needs to have more certainty, I think, is huge.
At least one Tea Party group said that Congressman Paul Ryan can kiss goodbye his chances of being president in 2016. How is this going to affect Paul Ryan, Kevin?
Just out of curiosity, which group was that?
Bill will have to tell me. There was some Tea Party groups who were upset that this particular deal was not conservative enough.
Well, I mean, let's also be realistic on that side. If Paul Ryan doesn't run for president, his consolation prize is House Ways and Means Chairman, so I think he'll be fine.
There you have it.
I mean, it's one of these things where, I mean, I understand the frustration of these Tea Party groups. I understand the thinking of them. But also, many of these groups are, you know, as someone who's worked former Republican Senate campaigns, gets incredibly frustrated with these guys because they've probably been the sole reason or one of the sole reasons why we get very strange, weirdo candidates who survive these primaries and then make Todd Akin-like statements. So, I mean, and it's one of these things where, you know, the purity, you understand the purity purge. Also, it's just incredibly just unrealistic, and you find getting these wackaloon candidates. So, I mean, and also, you know, I've gotten many of their emails over the last week, and it, you know, I got to the point where I was literally playing a game. How many sentences into the email did I finally get to donate click?
Yeah,
so a lot of this is about building email lists, building finances, mm-hmm. building a financial coffers, and you know, a political racket in which you actually have to applaud the right for taking a page from the left, in which they've just done what liberals did during the Bush administrations and just live off of rage politics.
Well, just by the way, it is the teaparty.net. The founder of teaparty.net said his name's Todd Seferi.
I've never heard of these guys.
If Paul Ryan puts his name
everywhere,
yeah.
All right. Website and a PayPal accounts only you matter, apparently.
I think the troubling long term consequence of this goes back to what I mentioned earlier, though, and that is that if we are to have a participatory democracy where people feel that they can be involved and feel that in some fashion their voices are being listened to, we need to have a respect for the democracy which is there. That doesn't mean you don't want to necessarily change it. There are a lot of ways I'd love to change the democracy that we have. I'm sure there are even more ways Kevin would like to see it changed. But if you think that it is fundamentally bad and your only goal is to destroy it, and having those goals in a way that's very superficial and not really deeply thought out, I think that that's problematic. And I think Boehner's remarks he made after this conclusion kind of go to that, and it's sort of like, hey, wait, guys, you know, you may not like what was there before, but this isn't, you know, you're not giving us reasonable alternatives. And I think that you're seeing now the Republican Party perhaps addressing that at least a little bit, because otherwise, you know, we're going to have, you know, with all due respect to witches, more of those kinds of candidates running.
I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Week in Review, talking today to Peg Lautenschlager and Kevin Benversi about the top news stories of the week. Let's talk a little bit about the farm bill or the farm law. The House passed an extension of the current farm law until the end of January. Dairy subsidies expire at the end of the year, triggering fears that we might fall off the dairy cliff and milk prices would skyrocket. The Senate says it will not take up the bill. Some senators say an extension will only reduce pressure to pass a long-term farm bill. Peg, your thoughts on was this the right thing to do, a short-term fix?
I'm not a fan of short-term fixes regardless. I do think that the farm bill, while perhaps there are some changes that may need to be made, and I think all of us would disagree as to what those changes would be. At some point, we really need to see, have our legislators sit down and address this. You know, food is a necessary commodity, and there's no getting around that. And some of the subsidies that are in place have some logic to them. Others, I think, are totally ridiculous. The whole issue of food stamps is one where I know much ado is made on the conservative side of the ledger in terms of food stamp abuse. But, you know, I look even here in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, where my husband and I live, and he works in a school that used to be one of the SAGE schools, very low-income population, and he deals with little kids who come to school each day and make it for breakfast because that and lunch at school are perhaps going to be the only food they get. You know, are there sometimes abuses in the system? Of course there are. Are there abuses in any sort of system? There are abuses in tax deductions that are taken by large corporations or wealthy people. It doesn't mean that we do away with tax deductions. And likewise, I think we have to look at food stamps as keeping kids fed, keeping veterans fed, keeping senior citizens fed. And so coming up with a farm bill that makes sense is something that I think is totally necessary.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, what makes sense with the farm bill?
Oh, well, admittedly, I'm always a fan of the old 1996 Freedom to Farm Act, but the farm bills that have come since then have been just bloated government, nightmares. I mean, the 2002 bill was more political than anything, you know, and then followed by the 2008 bill, I believe, and then now this one. I mean, it's more about pretty much trying to pay off, you know, insane agribusiness things. I mean, I understand. In Iowa and in New Hampshire, and it's all this really stupid regional cronyism that's going on, where we gotta make sure the beet farmers in Georgia get their stuff, and then the sugarcane farmers in Hawaii get their thing, and nobody's allowing market forces to work anymore, especially when it comes to farm subsidies. So it's a travesty to anything you want to call free market. As for food stamps, that always in my mind should have been a separate bill, and it's only been thrown in there because you have rural congressmen on both sides of the aisle who need urban Democrats to help pass the bill. So it's the whole mechanics behind farm policy is a mess. And if, you know, farmers, you know, and the farm lobby want to get upset, you know, over the next month, they can, you know, since it's held up in the Senate by Senate Democrats, by all means, Tammy Baldwin, 608 something 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 something.
Also about a free market in farming, and the reality is we no longer have a free market in farming.
No, we have
some giant powers that are out there who pretty much control development of seeds. We have giant powers out there that control a lot of the growth. And so to pretend that somehow the small businessman in the world of farming has a chance of surviving is a big push.
Let's move on to another issue because we're running short on time. The world said goodbye in a number of ceremonies this week to former South African President Nelson Mandela. President Obama ordered flags to be flown at half staff until this coming Monday. Governor Walker followed suit, but Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner says lowering the American flag should be done only to honor Americans. The governor disagreed with Congressman Sensenbrenner. Who's right and wrong here, Kevin, and why?
I actually side with Governor Walker on this one. In the past, we've actually lowered flags to half staff for other foreign heads of state. I mean, Winston Churchill, when he passed, we lowered our flags to half staff, as well as Pope John Paul II. So I understand where Sensenbrenner's coming from, but, you know, in those cases where it's like, you know, it's presidential and executive discretion, so it's completely up to the head of state.
Mm-hmm. Peg?
And I think that this is kind of an indication of how long Jim Sensenbrenner's been in this Congress. I mean, his reaction is kind of one of those of, oh, my God, Mandela's a communist. You know, that was decades ago. You know, I mean, this is a man who wears a tie with pigs so he can proudly acclaim being a male chauvinist pig. I think that he is somebody whose day has come and gone, and as a result, he is applying standards that would have been applied 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago to Mandela in terms of the whole flag at half-mast.
Yeah, controversy over President Obama shaking the hand of Castro at the ceremony. Was that a big deal, Kevin?
In the long term, no, but it's just one of those things where I think, you know, it probably was more spur of the moment. It's more intriguing when you find out, you know, in the past, I mean, I think it was in 2000 at a UN thing, Bill Clinton shook Fidel Castro's hand. This is Raul Castro that President Obama shook the hand of, and immediately had the White House in complete denial mode because apparently it was behind the scenes, and, you know, it's not going to change U.S.-Cuban relations one bit, but it's going to rile up, you know, Little Havana in Miami, which, you know, is always going to rile up.
Peg?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you on that. You know, and it isn't just Bill Clinton shaking Fidel's hand. I think the Democrats and Republicans alike, Muammar Gaddafi and John McCain, the very person complaining about this. I mean, there are a ton of examples like this that have come post-Cold War, during the Cold War even. And I think that this is where I become very conservative, and I think that formality and what's etiquette at events like these is something which we need to do. I don't think that, you know, not shaking his hand doesn't really prove anything other than to, you know, put another little pin in the voodoo doll or something. But I just don't see it as something where it really makes sense to get all upset.
Yeah, there was a bit of unusual news coming from the Mandela ceremonies and a lot of social media chatter, talk show chatter, about the selfie that President Obama took with the prime ministers of Denmark and England while the First Lady sat by looking upset. What do you make of all this, Peg?
First of all, I think the question of the selfie is a little odd. I mean, I think ordinarily at an event like that, taking one of those kinds of pictures would not be true to etiquette. But yet, on the other hand, I think if you look at the way in which South Africans used the memorial service more so as a celebration of Mandela's life and not as a vehicle for mourning, which I think, frankly, they've kind of been doing that for a while, perhaps, you know, gives them a buy on that. As to Mrs. Obama, I think the First Lady was told by the photographer that indeed she wasn't mad, and then of course they came up with another bad picture. Having been in those photos where somebody catches your face in a sour glance, I have some skepticism in terms of that. I think she was probably just trying to listen to what was going on.
Yeah, did you think that this was unnecessary criticism of President Obama, Kevin, or not?
Honestly, I take my criticism towards the Dutch prime minister for whipping out the cell phone in the first place. That's a memorial. I'm a little old school. I mean, a couple months ago, you know, I was at the funeral for my uncle, and, he was an 83-year-old father of 14, great guy, great businessman. And I'm thinking, you know, last thing in my head is, yeah, you know, Uncle Dick would love if I pulled out the cell phone right now to take a picture of me and my dad.
You know, while you say that, though, my very Republican aunt and uncle, my aunt died, and they were taking pictures with a cell phone of her in her casket, which I thought was weird. So
very weird. I'm sorry.
I don't know what to say.
I understand joking with relatives in the receiving line because you want to have those memories and the joy of celebrating someone's life, but also you're head of state. The last thing you're thinking to yourself is, wow, I got David Cameron to the right of me. I got the president to the – I got Obama to the left of me. Let's put this on Facebook.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just very weird.
Well, you do have to admit, though, Kevin, that indeed the way in which death is handled in a place like that is far different than it is in the U.S.
Another strange story coming from the Mandela Memorial Service. A South African deputy cabinet minister says a mistake happened in the hiring of a sign language interpreter for the Service, who experts say was signing gibberish on stage to while he was standing next to world leaders. South African official apologized to deaf people who were offended, and some, though, are saying, gosh, this, you know, here world leaders are standing just feet away from this guy who apparently, some are saying, had mental illness problems as well. And anything on that, Peg?
Well, you know, it's funny, Joy, because as you may recall back in the late 80s, 90s, and then also when I was Attorney General in the last 10 years ago or so, one of the issues that has always arisen in our court system here is whether or not someone has a right to an interpreter, whether it be a foreign language interpreter or somebody who can sign. And we have expanded those rights for people who are charged with crimes, but we have been very slow-going in expanding those rights to people who find themselves as defendants in civil cases. And among the people who are always pushing for this kind of legislation are those people who have the license to do signing, that kind of thing, licensed signers, I guess you'd call them. And then, of course, everybody's always looking for a cheaper way out, saying, well, you know, does the person really have to have this certificate? Can't we just bring in somebody who we know speaks Spanish or who we know can sign? And I thought, oh, my gosh, this is like the ultimate of the, good intentions gone awry. But that was bizarre.
Bizarre, Kevin?
Utterly bizarre. The first thoughts I have is Saturday Night Live's cold open is going to be awesome this week. Secondly, given everything about the schizophrenia, the fact that the company that hired him has vanished into thin air, and everything else like that is, thank God we saw his hands at all times.
Yeah.
You know, because Lord only knows with all those world leaders, you know, what could have happened. And then secondly, I was reading this morning, Politico had it that there was even more issues with security at that event. They weren't searching bags. They weren't doing pat-down, you know, just standard pat-downs of people going in. I mean, you have countless hundred world leaders there. They're not going through metal detectors. And I understand, yeah, this is a celebration of man's life, but, you know, that could have been a tragedy on international scale. It's been weird. Yes, we've had some great laughs out of it. I mean, Jimmy Kimmel this week had a hilarious segment where he actually brought someone who knows American Sign Language on as a special, showed him the tape and said, well, what's he saying? Oh, like, well, it's utter gibberish. So, like, they'd show a couple segments of the guy, and he'd, like, try to translate, like, hello, how are you? And, like, you'd have, like, the president going, you know, saying what he's saying. It was hilarious.
Oh, no. I get it.
It's just, yeah. Oh, my goodness.
We are talking with Kevin Benversi. He's a freelance writer, blogger. He used to work for the Heritage Foundation, served in the George W. Bush administration, and worked on several state Republican campaigns. And Peg Lautenschlager, former Democratic Attorney General of Wisconsin, former state lawmaker, former United States attorney, now an attorney with the Bauer and Bach law firm. This is our Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. Time now for our Week in Review quiz. The first significant snowstorm of the season to hit southeastern Wisconsin arrived on Sunday, making a real mess of the roadways and causing numerous accidents. Which Wisconsin lawmaker was injured in one of those accidents? 1-800-642-1234. If you'd like to guess, you can also email your answer to talk@wpr.org. We're just going to give you 5 minutes, then we will randomly select a winner from all of the correct answers and give you the answer and the winner at the end of today's Week in Review. This is the Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Peg Lautenschlager and Kevin Benversi about the news of the week. Let's talk about some state news. Governor Walker signed 23 bills into law yesterday, 23 of them. We won't talk about all of them, but one of them restricts public access to a potential iron mine in northern Wisconsin. Another one deals with apartment tenants, gives landlords more rights over tenants. He did not sign the bill that pertains to Indian mascots, which will become law if the governor doesn't take action in the next week. Let's, Kevin, why do you think he's not signing this mascot bill?
I think he is probably looking at political considerations. He knows he doesn't want to get the Indian tribes, any Indian tribe, upset with him as re-election time is coming. So he's probably just going to pocket the bill. It will become law without his signature, and he can say, hey, you know, time ran out. But I think that's the overall thing. My base understanding from friends in the state capitol is he does support the law, because the first law passed by Democrats in 2010 pretty much set up a kangaroo court and gave a lot of school districts headaches and a guilty first, innocence never mentality.
Mm-hmm. Peg?
Well, first of all, I think that the new legislation is sad, and I think it's sad for kids who aren't part of majority groups where there may be some historical misconceptions or stereotypes that aren't good. And I think because of that, doing something this trivial on something as, you know, minor as school sporting events, I know that everybody loves them, and I know that they are important in terms of kids' development and whatever else. But the reality is we have a lot higher up. We have a lot more. We have a lot of issues that should fall much higher in the scale in terms of what's important in life. But secondly, I think is the sadness of the governor, doing the pocket passing, the pocket signature thing as such. I mean, this is that does not show strength in terms of governing. It shows wanting to avoid an issue and trying to be all things to all people, and in doing so, probably being nothing to anyone.
Governor Walker did sign a bill this week that would increase requirements for high school math and science classes that students would have to take for graduation. The bill raises the math and science requirement for graduation from 2 credits each to 3 credits each. Peg, is that a good law?
I think it's a good law. I think, though, we need to make certain that there are resources sufficient in order to make certain that kids can get through those classes. I saw one of the provisions of the bill has allows kids to take things, I think maybe agriculture as a science course or this or that, in an attempt to get what some might call easier classes, not that they necessarily are, in order to get those credits out of the way. But I think in the end, I don't know, as a daughter of 2 school teachers, public school teachers, I grew up with that philosophy is, you know, you can buy a kid a car tomorrow and they'll crash it. But if you give them an education, no one can ever take it away. And I think that's true. And I think that doing what we can to beef up curriculum is important. I think, though, that it requires not just these mandates in terms of what needs to be done, but it also is going to need to ensure that we have the resources, the kind of curriculum that's needed and the like.
Mm-hmm. Kevin?
I thought there were it was a fair bill, and I mean, I wouldn't say that agriculture is not a science. I mean, I think the gang at UW Madison would definitely disagree with that statement.
Well, I don't. I'm not saying it isn't, Kevin. Don't get me wrong.
I think it was also kind of a way to allow what are, you know, especially traditional industry in Wisconsin, you know, to allow those kids who, you know, may either decide to go to a UW to get a further agricultural sciences degree or, you know, a jump start on that degree. Or instead of just being an easy, I mean, the computer science for math idea, I especially love considering the amount of coding that is now needed and math skills that's now needed in coding, you know, is very acrable and works one and the same.
I need to talk about another education-related issue. A Republican-led state assembly committee that was formed to study the Common Core academic standards in Wisconsin is not recommending that they be scrapped, despite some pressure that they do just that. Instead, the recommendations call for establishing a process for the continued review and adoption of standards that involves legislative control and public comment. The committee said that Wisconsin would be best served by creating state-based standards, but it does not call for that to be done. So, Kevin, what's up with this?
I'm probably that rare conservative who isn't really paying that much attention to the Common Core debate, just because it's there's so much muddled stuff and you have so many guys screaming at you. I've talked with some education experts and some school choice experts, and they're not opposed to Common Core because, as you said, the problem with Wisconsin is there's no actual statewide curriculum, you know, plateau to hit. In a perfect system, what I would love is every, you know, year, 2 years, 5 years, whatever, DPI, state legislature, sits together with the top 10 school districts in the state, find out what they're doing right, and then set that as the statewide bar. So that's just me.
Peg?
Well, I always have concerns because in education you can get schools that are incredibly different from one another. I see that even here in little old Fond du Lac, where the grade school where my husband works is filled with, it's a low-income kids. Majority of them have parents who didn't finish high school, much less go to college. Another grade school in town, all high-income, you know, upper middle class, upper class kids who are all expected to go to college. Comparing one school to the other is like apples and oranges. We do need to have some sort of standards, some sort of requirements that all children are expected to meet. We shouldn't downgrade kids simply because of economic status or things that impact, have been shown to impact their ability to achieve. But on the other hand, I think we have to realize that just setting the standards in place is not enough. You have to have the action plan and the resources in order to afford kids the opportunity to meet those goals and requirements, and that's where the big question lies.
All right, so quickly, one more issue before we're through here. A Green Bay Republican lawmaker is proposing requiring schools to teach gym class for at least 30 minutes a day. He says this will help make students healthier and also help them learn better. So a 30-minute a day Phi-Ed class for elementary schools in Wisconsin, Peg, is that a good idea?
I don't know, you know, I mean, I think that if they're going to look at that, we need to figure out what the curriculum is going to be, and is it going to be something that's meaningful in terms of young kids getting practices in place that afford them to understand that burning calories, doing some exercise, whatever, playing certain games is a good thing. I'm not opposed to that. I think, though, the real question becomes when you start nickel and diming things piece by piece in a fractional kind of way where we say, you know, we need this, next we need, you know, music for a half hour, then we need 2 hours of math or whatever it happens to be, and then you end up with, you know, folks in the legislature dictating how education should be.
Yeah, let's get a quick react from Kevin.
I miss the days when, you know, my father would just unplug the Nintendo, stare at me, my brothers and sisters, and say, get outside. So we've lost it in society, and part of it is because, you know, TV's become a very reliable babysitter for many parents, as well as the Nintendo, Xbox, and PlayStation. So, I mean, I understand what Representative Weininger's doing, and it's one of those things where it's, you know, you're staring at, you know, high childhood obesity rates, but it's just, you know, an unnecessary evil.
Well, let's time for the Week in Review quiz answer. And congratulations to Debbie in Laval. She was chosen our winner. Which Wisconsin lawmaker was injured in an accident on the snowy roads from Sunday? It was State Senator Kathleen Vinehout. The Democratic State Senator and likely candidate for governor was reportedly in Racine County on her way to Milwaukee when the car she was in crashed on Interstate 94. It hasn't been reported on exactly what happened, but apparently she broke her arm in multiple places. Vinehout's husband says she is home now and doing well. So we do wish her well on that. By the way, we will be talking more about safe winter driving tips and emergency preparedness and about Wisconsin's winter weather on Monday in our 6 o'clock hour. Peg and Kevin, stay safe, okay?
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the opportunity to be on, Joy.
Peg Lautenschlager, former Democratic Attorney General, and Kevin Ben-Brucey, a freelance writer and blogger. Thanks to Bill Martins for producing this hour. Thanks to Christy Taylor for on-air production. This is the Ideas Network.